Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Yeah. Hey, Scott, we are recording this on a computer.
Is that what that thing is?
And if you have a computer, you can go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC to get 3 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, free U.S. shipping. What are you doing?
I'm turning on your high-pass filter because you need it.
Okay. And I don't remember where I left off. You guys know the promo. Damn it.
Three free DVDs, free shipping in the U.S.,
a free mystery gift and 50% off of a
50% off a main item have just
using the promo code STATIC. Please. The reason I brought up the computer is you're about to get to nerd out. We're starting a new series within our series here of, I don't want to call it the history of the computer, because we're going to be dealing with various aspects of computers and how they have changed the world, really.
Well, yeah. I mean, you talk about things, and people think back to the 50s and 60s, and they go, that was the jet age. That was the age of the jet setter and vacuum tubes and such. And then you talk about from 70s through the 80s, well, early 70s through the 80s, you have the space age. And we're going to space. We got shuttle and everything. Well, the 90s came around, and we saw another revolution. The information age came around, and that's when people went, we really don't need flying cars because we can share information quickly, and maybe we don't need.
I still would like a flying car.
I would love a flying car, but me. And people have pointed out that there are those convertible cars. There are some cars that are in like special production right now, and they're a couple million a piece, and you can drive them to the airport and flip a button, and wings come down, and an aircraft engine starts. But that's
would hovercrafts technically be flying because they're not on the ground?
No,
I mean you're only flying a half inch off the ground, but you're still technically flying.
No, it's not flying. It's hovercrafts and what they call ground. They're in the deal of ground effects aircraft. Ekranoplans. It's a really not a very well-known thing. They were very big in the Soviet Union. Big, huge, giant, multi-engined things that ran across the Caspian Sea, flying 50 to 100 feet tops. And it's what's called a ground effect aircraft. And you can see this on regular aircraft if you ever fly. And I realize this is a little off topic, but we'll get there. As you come into a landing, when you hit a certain level, that 50 feet down on a small aircraft, you get to being what's called wing in effect or wing in ground effect. And because of the way the air flows under the wing, you get this kind of pocket of very high pressure.
It kind of gives you extra lift.
Yeah, a lot of people call it false lift, but lift is lift. And it can be very hard for an aircraft moving at even relatively low speeds to get down below that 50 foot because of this weird wing effect. So,
science,
especially the Soviets kind of capitalized on this and created these gigantic, huge, I mean, just huge
red
cargo
bastards.
Aircraft. That would just zip across the Caspian Sea because there's very little friction, obviously, and it doesn't take quite as much engine power to lift you, and you don't fly higher than, like I said, anywhere from usually 50 to 75 feet off the ground. And there are a few civilian versions that are even available here in the U.S., and when you've got a hovercraft with that nice little skirt directing that air downward and everything, you're creating a little micro version of wing and ground effect. And
which
so,
would technically be flying then.
Not really, because they're, you know, then people can fly because they can jump a few inches off the ground. They just don't fly very far.
I'm not arguing
and
that with
doesn't,
that.
That doesn't work.
I'm not so arguing most, with that.
Yeah.
Hey, little stupid bit of trivia. You know, sure. Superman originally couldn't fly?
Yeah, I know.
All he could do was leap tall buildings
in
a
single
bound.
Right.
Yeah, he couldn't fly. That wasn't added until the 40s.
That's right. That's right. So, History of computers. Do you want to start at the very beginning?
I don't want this to be dry and analytical. Make it interesting.
Okay, no problem. When I say the first computer, what comes to mind for you?
Commercially or industrially?
No, when I just say the first computer, that's the only phrase you get. I'm not going to get any more specific. What comes to mind?
I'm going to out myself as the movie nerd again. One of them big James Bond computers from a 60s Bond film that took up the whole room and used punch cards.
So you're talking like an IBM, the old IBM.
I don't know if it was IBM. I just remember something. It might have not even been a Bond film. It might have been an Italian Bond ripoff that had one of those. But you know what I'm talking about, those big computers.
Well, believe it or not, you're actually quite a ways off.
You asked what I thought of. You didn't ask what the first was.
I know. But you're actually, well done. You're actually quite a ways off because the first computer actually came out of ancient China. And it was a simple abacus. Technically is a computer.
Because it computates?
Yes. Because it makes computing things and, you know, adding, subtracting, doing stuff like that much simpler. So beads on a rack. Now, when we start talking about what people think of as, you know, the ancestor to the modern computer, it's kind of interesting, but in the 19th century, the first computers were books of tables, and you would hire a person that knew these tables really, really well to help with your accounting. And
early forensic accountants.
Yeah, and do you know what they were technically called? And if you go back into the, like, J.P. Morgan and the old industrialists, they'll have their employees listed. Do you know what they were called?
Idiot savants?
Nope. Computers. So if you wanted to hire a computer, it was a person that would read these tables and
work out all the stuff.
Who happened
to usually be an idiot savant.
No.
Rain Man. Yeah. Well, I gotta watch Wapner.
But
I just realized just how dated that is. Wapner hasn't been on People's Court in how many fucking a decade now?
Over.
Jeez.
It's been longer than that because he wasn't even on when I was in college.
But technically, he moved to the Animal Planet, remember? Animal Court?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So even after he left People's Court, he was still on TV.
And is he Judge Judy's husband? Because I know Judith Scheinlin was married to somebody that had a TV court show.
I think she'd be the husband.
Just about. But anyway, there was during the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, as they were going through these tables, there was a gentleman by the name of Charles Babbage. And Babbage looked at these tables and kind of double-checked them and worked out all the math and was finding just error after error after error.
Human error, literally.
Yeah, literally human error in these books and books of tables that they were using. So, you know, accounting for the, you know, J.P. Morgan could have been more rich than he was. And, you know, Carnegie could have been a whole lot more richer than he was. Who knows? God forbid that.
I prefer to think of it as a very complicated embellishment scheme. On the part of the accountants. It makes me feel better.
Look, that's exactly how most of Wall Street works today. It's all very complicated embellishment schemes.
Isn't that how the government works, too?
Yeah, just about. So, you have Charles Babbage, who discovered this stuff, and he came along, and he goes, there has got to be a way that we can do these complicated calculations in real time as we need them. You know, that way there's no looking it up in tables and maybe somebody looks, you know, down this column and oops, we're off a row, but meh, screw it, you know. And plus you wouldn't end up with the errors that end up in the tables. You tabulate it right then and there. And so he came up with this really brilliant idea called the difference engine. And it was, by all means, it was an analog computer. It had a central calculating unit, a system of gears that you could change, and that's how you did your calculations. It had a display of a bunch of these dials that would, you know, click to the right number and give you the answers that you needed. There was rudimentary analog RAM.
Well, I've got a question for you then. Okay, if that was the first, as you called it, analog computer, how did the vacuum tube shit work? Because you see that in old documentaries and even a lot of steampunk kind of shit. How did that actually work?
How does a vacuum tube work?
Well, how does it work in reference to a computer? That's where I'm lost.
Well, a vacuum tube is... it's a complicated switch. On or off. And if you know anything about digital computing, you know that we have ones and zeros.
Binary.
Right, binary. On and off. And using a binary system is how they do all of their tabulating. And then it's converted into a decimal system or...
it's the Matrix! It's the Matrix, man!
Yeah, or hexadecimal system or something and displayed to us. Well, a vacuum tube was a more complicated switch. It could be on or it could be off. And it could switch a little bit faster than analog switches or relays.
Okay, it just always seemed overly complicated and I still never understood it.
I mean, that's the root of it. On, off. There you go.
Okay.
And vacuum tubes were a little bit faster than gears and relays. And transistors were smaller and a little bit faster.
But you got to admit, they look cooler when you're going for like a cyberpunky steampunk aesthetic.
Oh, they really do. And that big red glowing wall of vacuum tubes that's up there.
It always looks like Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein's lab kind of shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You almost expect, I always called them Jacob's Ladders, but there were the little towers with the...
Tesla coil.
No, Tesla coil was different, but...
well, no, because he used the two Tesla coils in Bride of Frankenstein to bring her up. He had the big...
yeah, he had
curly
the big
ones.
The
yeah,
big,
with yeah the... I'm thinking more Bride of Frankenstein.
But I was thinking of the one with the little arc of electricity that would just go, you know, up to the top.
I'm not getting near that goddamn thing. I got burned on the Return of Shandau.
There you go.
How many of you got that?
Not too many, I'm willing
did you?
To no.
Martin Landau as Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood.
Ah, okay.
I wasn't even going to pretend to do the Hungarian accent, but...
that's no problem. See, had you done the Hungarian accent, I would have gotten it, but...
I think I would have butchered that worse than you can imagine I would have butchered that.
That's probably safe. But nonetheless, Babbage came up with this difference engine, and it ended up being... the manufacturing process to make the gears exact as they needed to be and down to that, it didn't exist. So in order to build the difference engine, he had to come up with new manufacturing techniques to get these gears to the exact specifications he needed and such. Lots of money, right? And you've got, at the beginning, he was able to get some decent backing. But it took so long that the difference engine was never actually built. Never actually built. Part of it was, and if you look it up on Google Images, you'll see that part that was finally built. And it was amazing. But he lost his difference. He also shot himself in the foot. Because while he was trying to build the difference engine, he came up with a better idea. And he wrote out plans for what was called the analytical engine. And the analytical engine is one that had an old analog hard drive on it. It had RAM, or at least an analog equivalent, using springs and such for temporary storage of figures. And it had this even more complex and faster processing unit through more exact gears and stuff like that. And in the middle of, before he'd even delivered his difference engine to companies, he comes about with the analytical engine and goes, hey, look at this. Here's a better idea. And I could do this. I just need a whole lot more money.
Well, see, okay, you mentioned an analog hard drive.
Right.
Now, I've heard this, I've heard a theory that some people say the first mass market analog hard drive were records. That because basically that's what you're doing. You are storing, in this case, sound into the grooves of a record to be either mass produced or reused, or later down the line, tape, you know, reel-to-reel tapes and whatnot. Something like that?
Something like that, yeah. I mean, to me, the very first mass-produced analog hard drive was paper.
Yeah, yeah, but...
I mean, it's a way of storing information for archiving and
later
such
use.
That later use, you know. And that, to me, was the first mass-marketed hard drive. It was just... Most people don't think of it that way.
Well, then when did we get what we think of today? Obviously not the modern version, but what we think of today as the computer.
Well, that came about, I mean, that really came about thanks to a gentleman named Mollerith. And Mollerith made, for the 1890 census, he made tabulating machines. And that was basically all they did was they took information and tabulated it and created these rows and information for the 1890 census, and they used punch cards. So your census taker would go out into your neighborhood. Well, here's a single family home, punch. Well, here's it's got a dad, punch, a mom, punch, and some kids, punch, punch, punch. And they're Catholic, punch, you know, and they would literally go out with these little punch cards and
then you feed them into the machine.
Exactly. And he got the idea of watching a conductor punch a train ticket. And he goes, aha, a hole in paper is stored information, which is, you know, this person has used this ticket in the case of the conductor, punch. And so he came up with it, and he did that and fed them in. And Mollerith eventually, from his tabulating machine company, turned it into International Business Machines. So he was the one that came about with IBM. And
well, we should also point out that IBM, since you just brought them up, a lot of people don't realize everyone loves their IBM and all that, okay? You guys know that they willingly made computers for the Nazis so they could keep records at concentration camps, right? People, IBM, you'll notice if you go to their history on their website, they leave that aspect out that, yes, we built custom-made machines for the Nazi Third Reich all the while so they could keep records and track of the concentration camps and what they did to them.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't. You know I don't like whitewashing.
I know.
So I just... I want to point that out, that it's funny how they kind of go, yeah, even though we did that, we don't really want you to remember that we did that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's to me, if you're running a business, it's I will make this for you, what you do with it
is
yours.
No, because there's got to be a moral component.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think there has to be a moral component to
it. I know, and the question is, did IBM know what it was for and blah, blah, blah?
They were custom made for the Nazis. There's no way you didn't know.
Who knows? But anyway, the IBM came about and made these tabulating machines. IBM were the ones that came up with the old adding machines, where you always see them in you know, chunk, 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 pull the big lever.
Chunk, chunk.
Yeah, you know, and there's we've got our figures entered. And even my stepfather at one point was a salesman for IBM.
My grandfather had one of them. Counting machines, mm-hmm. And you know it didn't work at the point when I was a little kid, but I would always just that chunk chunk sound. Oh, yeah. It sounded like you were cutting some guy in half or something. I always wanted to take that apart and put like a G.I. Joe in there and see if I could sever him in two with that. Maybe that's just how my mind worked. I don't know.
That would be your brain, Josh.
Sorry,
not normal people. But IBM. Then they came about with the first. Truly digital machines. And we're still working with analog stuff. We're still working with springs and levers and things like that, on, off. And that's what the tabulating machines did. And they went from that. And when the vacuum tube came about, the reason that we have the first modern computers, funny you should bring up World War II, because the first modern computers were made to come up with firing solutions. Ends up when you're on a battleship and you want to launch a shell into a city or into an opponent, coming up with that exact arc that we do when you're playing with Angry Birds and you're kind of guessing.
I've never played Angry Birds.
Well, everybody else has.
Was that a shot? Was that a fucking shot?
No, not in a million years. But it ends up coming up with that exact parabola that you're looking for is a very difficult calculation.
Yeah, IBM was selling weapons to both sides, or they were selling computers to both sides.
They were selling computers to both sides. They would not. Now, they didn't. You bring up the Nazis and tabulating and all of that. That's all old technology, the old technology of tabulating and everything. That's what they gave to the Nazis. The new stuff, the vacuum tube computers, which were ENIAC and UNIVAC and stuff like that, were developed by and for our government for coming up with those firing solutions. And it worked. It worked quite well. Because somebody with UNIVAC could radio a firing solution back to a battleship in the heat of battle a whole lot faster than the way that many of our enemies did it, including the Japanese and some of the other Axis powers, actually had mathematicians on board the ship.
Yeah.
And they would sit there and they would work out the firing solution and then give it to them. Well, our guys would radio back to Boston, where UNIVAC was, or wherever it happened to be, and they would feed in the firing solution and then radio the firing solution back, and boom, we hit the other ship or the land deal, and we killed the mathematician before he could finish his calculations. And that's what they were used for. I mean, wartime, World War II really brought about all of these technological revolutions. That,
well, that's not necessarily a good thing, because I mean, you know, Project Paperclip, when all the Nazi war criminals were gone, hey, I have medical knowledge that you don't. I get immunity, you get it. A lot of the medical technology we have today is stemmed from research done by Nazi criminals on innocent Jews. So that also comes from World War II. That doesn't mean it was right to have done it.
You know, Rose's girl from Piles of Poop.
Okay, maybe I'm, surprisingly enough, choosing morality here.
And I think more long term. How many more lives were saved by this horrible, terrible stuff being done versus not? You know, where would we be today if it hadn't happened? Well, that's a moral, that's a gray area for me. Not real comfortable with it. But that's the way it is. Our first digital computers with, vacuum tubes and stuff, and then eventually transistors came about, which just basically took the vacuum tube, made it cooler, smaller, and when I say cooler, I mean literally.
Yes. No. You don't mean more. Warm. You don't mean more awesome.
Well, it was more awesome at the same time, but.
Well, okay. Let's move to a different aspect. Okay. And I specifically want to leave home computing and the internet out, because those are separate episodes down the line. So
that's way.
I really do. Well, and I just don't even really want to deal with those tonight. Those are separate episodes.
I was going to say we're 40 years away from that yet.
But
so
what happened with the whole computers getting more powerful? Because you hear this all the time, and it's not inaccurate. It's just one of those, it's so shocking to think of that you go, that can't be right. That the moon landing, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, etc., the moon landing was done with the computing power of a 1980s wristwatch.
Yeah.
At what point did that shift come in when... Well, because I mean, that is just shocking in and of itself that little bit of computing power could do that. And now you look at NASA and there's rooms of this shit and all this crap. And you go, at what point did the shift happen where you either needed more or you just couldn't get by with less? Does that make sense how I worded it?
I think the shift happened specifically with NASA, the shift happened when we won the space race. I mean, if you really think about the problem and you take the human aspect out of it and you take keeping people alive out of it and you go, I want to get a ball to the moon to land and keep that ball intact, our theoretical golf ball. Well, it's really pretty basic math. You need a set amount of thrust to escape velocity. You need a set amount of directional thrust in order to get it into an Earth orbit. You need a little bit more thrust to get it around an Earth orbit and fling it towards the moon. Well, then you need some pretty, I mean, this is basic math of where is the moon going to be when we fling the golf ball? Which way do we need to fling the golf ball?
How long is it going to take so we can hit the moon?
Exactly. How fast do we want the golf ball traveling toward the moon? Well, that's where the human stress testing comes in, and you go, well, how much can a man take? And it's really, people forget that this is really pretty basic physics. I mean, it was an amazing feat when you throw the human aspect in and you go, we got to keep these people alive and keep their systems up and running and all of that and get them home. But if you boil it down to the math and the actual computing power needed to do it, you can do it on a TI calculator.
Right, which is my point, that then why do they have so much today? I mean, obviously, you know, part of it is safety and ease, but if they could do it in the 60s, you know, if they could do it in 1969 with that little bit, why do they need a million times that little bit to do not even that today?
Their motivation changed. Number one, we don't have the big bad red enemy breathing down our neck.
Sometimes
competition
can breed ingenuity.
It really can. And the other thing is, you've got the social aspect of NASA now. They've had some disasters. They're not, people that work at NASA, you got to remember that they used to be gigantic heroes. They could do no wrong. And if there happened to be a mistake, well, then their scientists made a mistake. Let's move on. We've got to push on.
Okay, it's like the episode of The Simpsons where Homer went into space. Americans see our astronauts as eager young go-getters. They hate that type of person now.
And you've got the social aspect of NASA to deal with. You've got social networking of NASA. You've got, I mean, look at the Canadian. I feel awful, but I can't remember his name. The Canadian astronaut that was up on the space station, and he tweeted, you know, he tweeted from there, and he showed a bunch of pictures from there, and he did Space Oddity when he was leaving. He did the music video in the, anyway. Everybody is shouting their name at the radio right now.
Was he stepping through the door?
Yes. Yes, he was.
From Space Oddity. Never mind.
I know.
Go ahead.
But nonetheless, you've got that social aspect of it now. I think that people are a lot less far removed from NASA and from these scientists, and they need that extra computing power because it's a whole lot more complicated now with safety and everything like that, where back in the 60s during the space race, things could go wrong and things would go wrong and people gave their lives and they were great heroes. Let's push on. We've got to beat the Reds.
Safety took a back seat to
innovation.
Expediency.
Yeah.
No, I think expediency would be the more appropriate term there.
Yeah, that's true. But that's, you know, that was part of it. Now their motivations, well, we don't really have that big bad enemy because the Koreans can't launch a rocket into the Japanese ocean, let alone, you know, into space. And
have you seen, speaking of that, and I'm not changing the topic, do you see those computers of those pictures of the Korean computers? Have you seen those that they're using literally late 60s, early 70s technology in their, we will take on America?
Yeah.
And you're going, dude, you know the camera used to take the photo of that?
Yeah.
Is about 100 times more advanced than that computer itself, dude. Just relax, okay?
But back to the history of computers, we've got IBM to thank for all of this. I mean, they brought it into firing solutions in World War II, brought it into the vacuum tube era and the true digital, and they were still using punch cards to feed in, and you would either get a teletype to spit information out, or it would just spit more punch cards out, and you would still need somebody to read those punch cards. And that was what that was for. We moved in from vacuum tubes. They came up with the transistor, which I don't. Have you ever seen a transistor?
I believe so. I believe so.
Little cylinder.
Yeah.
Two little wires.
It actually kind of looks... I'm making a weird comparison. Kind of looks like a spark plug in a certain way.
In a weird certain way. I can see that. But you've got those transistors that it moved into, and they became even faster. They're still basically switches. They're still basically on and off. And if you... I realize I'm dumbing that down considerably from where it should be. So our computers went from this huge room-filling thing of one computer to do one task. They squeezed down so that you could get multiple computers into a room. And multiple computers for multiple tasks all at once. Still not really talking to one another.
Oh my God, the hard drive is crashing at an alarming rate!
Well, I always find it funny because there is this glorious picture of a 5 gigabyte hard drive being shipped by IBM to another IBM deal or a government deal.
On the back of a truck.
And no, it's in a plane, and it takes up the entire cylinder of the plane. It's being loaded onto, I think it's an old DC-3 or something, and it takes up like the whole back of the plane.
Now, just to put that in terms that you youngins might understand, your average uncompressed or at your average compressed DVD is 4.7 gigabytes.
Yeah.
So that's about a DVD.
Yeah. And even.
And a compressed one, too. Uncompressed, it's more than that.
Right, right. So it's you know, in order to store a movie, you need a plane.
Makes sense to me.
One movie. But and then versus right next to that is a photo of a little 5 gigabyte memory stick, you know, which neat.
Well, I mean, now this is getting a little into home computing, but I just was reading an old penthouse from 1994 the other day. I found it at Half Price Books for 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So from 1994, they had an ad in it for computer erotica. On floppy disk. And I'm just like, you know what? I want to see that. I want to find one of those just to see it, Scott. You telling me you wouldn't? Out of some weird morbid curiosity?
Yeah, I would. I'd have to find a computer with a disk drive now. But
I still have an old one in my basement that has a fucking disk drive.
Okay.
Haven't turned it on in a decade, but it's still there.
In fact, I remember... again, getting a little bit into home computing, but there used to be something similar at...
you guys might be hearing his freaking neighbor mowing the damn lawn.
Sorry about that. But you might remember... you remember shareware, of course. Back in the 90s, they would share the first episode and then get the rest of the game for free or whatever. Well... not only did our college bookstore stock shareware for like a buck a disc, which I always thought was funny, there was another guy that would bring in other floppies that
basically... don't copy that floppy!
That were basically erotica. And you could buy erotica on disc. And it was a student project. It wasn't really anything big. But he came up with the best solution, the best slogan I had heard in a long time. It goes... this disc may be floppy, but you won't be.
Well, see, one of the reasons I brought up that erotica thing was not to change the topic on you, but to most, as we've talked about in a previous episode, most innovations come from porno in some way.
Porn and war.
Yeah. So how does porn work into the innovation of the computer? Because yes, it does.
It does.
You and I both know porn always is involved in the innovation of every new technology.
Right. And we will get there. That's
porn, still down the line.
Yeah, that's still down the line.
I'm actually surprised at that point that they still weren't trying to trade some zero and one picture of a naked booby or something,
I got to tell you that in the universities that had these computers, these powerful computers, and in the businesses...
everybody loves boobies, even computer nerds.
Do you remember the big... these were huge, wide... They were like 2 foot wide printers that... we used them all the time in high school for turning in... assignments. We had to print them out.
The oldest printers I remember were the dot matrix ones, where when you tried to pull the all the dots off the side. It would always tear the fucking paper because they would never tear on the perforation.
Well, this was that kind of a dot matrix deal with the little things on the side, but it was about 2 feet wide, and the paper was basically newsprint.
Okay, no, I don't remember that specific
one. These were big. They were big in the universities, and you would do your assignment at the terminal, send it to the printer, travel across the stupid campus to pick up your job. Well, I can tell you that back in the day of even in punch card days, they were punching out pictures of boobies. And punching out pictures of naked women.
I'm just thinking of something. Wouldn't it be funny if you walked all the way across the quad and then you got in there? What the fuck does tray load letter black mean? Come on, modern printers.
Yeah. But one of the first earliest dot matrix printed pictures was that of a reclining woman in the nude done in ASCII art, which is still around. ASCII.
No, we used to do that when I was in high school.
Just look up ASCII art, and it's one of those where you're up close and you're like, okay, so that's a comma, that's a period.
And then you look, and you pull back a little, and you go, step back. Oh, boobies!
Yeah, you step back across the room, and you're like, that's a dick.
So I'm just saying porno helped move the computer along even before we got to
it. Motivated the scientists. Yeah. It motivated the scientists.
I'm sure it
that
did.
Made this happen.
How do they input all the code with one hand?
You input all the code first and then save that for afterward when it can display in front of you.
I don't have patience for that.
That's why you're not a computer scientist.
Yeah. Cause that's the reason.
Yeah, that's the one and only reason.
Yeah, that's the reason, Scott.
So, but anyway, we move on from analog computing, like the Babbage difference engine and the analytical engine. Same principles of RAM and hard disk space and a central processing unit and everything still apply in digital computing.
Okay, then at what point do we get what we consider? I'm just going to use Windows as an example. A Windows style, or even like an Apple II or like an Apple style, what we would consider the modern computer, even in its most prehistoric version.
Shortly after you and I were born.
Really? I would have thought that those, because I've seen old documentaries that would be pre-75.
And we're not.
You don't consider those. No,
they weren't. They weren't true. About? What you're talking about is what's called a GUI, graphical user interface.
Okay.
And those didn't. I mean, they were in their absolute infancy. Yes, in the late '60s, in their absolute infancy. In the early '70s, we started playing around with a mouse, literally a block of wood with two wheels on the bottom and a button to click. Once those two came together, thanks to Xerox PARC, it was, believe it or not, they didn't really come about until shortly after you and I were born. Even the first home computers were command line interface.
Well, then what would you consider the first real video game system, the Atari 2600, the Atari VCS? Would that be kind of a home computer? Because for a while, I've read a couple of different books on the history of video games. For a while, that's what they were considering selling these as, you know, a home computer. All it can do is play games, but they wanted to call it a computer because that term was starting to enter pop culture and mainstream culture.
Yeah, I mean,
so what would the Atari VCS be then?
It's a very specialized computer system. Okay. It's made for playing games, and it's made for playing games using people that don't really know how to run computers. They can throw a cartridge in and start it up.
And it does what the cartridge promised it can do.
Exactly. But it was still, I mean, you still interfaced with that with switches, and you still, even the joysticks were still just four switches, or later on, eight switches. It was still basically a command line interface with a little bit of an overlay. It wasn't a true graphical user interface.
You know what? We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
Definitely.
All right, guys and gals, here it is. 1201 Beyond is hosting an alternative tentacles contest. How do you enter? Most of that is up to you, actually. The only part we require is that you email your submission to 1201beyond@gmail.com after you have executed whatever it is. What is it that we're asking you to do? All you have to do is come up with the best and most unique way to get the Alternative Tentacles brand out there, or 1201 Beyond, that'd be nice as well. Tattoo the logo on your forehead, spray paint it on the side of a building, hack Spotify so all they play is Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine, whatever. That's all up to you. The most unique entry will win the newest Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine CD, White People and the Damage Done, the Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine EP, Shockupy, a DVD of Terminal City Ricochet, and an Alternative Tentacles t-shirt. What is stopping you? Go out and do it. 1201 Beyond and Alternative Tentacles are absolved of all legal responsibility due to the actions taken by the participants of this contest, and all costs and or penalties incurred are the sole responsibility of that person. 1201 Beyond and Alternative Tentacles does not encourage any illegal activity. The above examples were merely attempts to be fun.
It's a brilliant little contest you're running there.
Yeah, I figured we get them to advertise for us and we give them stuff.
That's smart thinking right there.
See, I should be in marketing.
No, that'd be a
I came up
thing.
With that idea. That was clever.
That'd be a dangerous thing. But nonetheless, back to computing power.
Back to computing power. Okay, nerd, go.
Okay. Well, you were asking about graphical user interfaces and stuff like that. That is, and that's post-home computer revolution. The home computer revolution came about in the 80s.
No, because like, but you're talking about, like we were talking about the Atari. Apple grew out of Atari. So right. Atari predates Apple, which right. is really the first major consumer.
Right, but that's computer. Still a very, very specialized computer. Yeah, they wanted to make it into something. You can do your accounting on your TV and stuff like that. But
green screen.
Not even green screen at the time. It was black and white. But let's. I mean, these are still very specialized video game computers. Yeah, they're computers. Yeah, they're in your home. But are they what we think of as our, you know, as a computer today?
Well, what about then, since we're going to leave home computers relatively out of it tonight, what about then, like, for government use and military use? When did that become like what an Apple II would be, for example? When did the military start adapting that? When did corporate America start adopting that?
Corporate America and the military.
Well, before you go on, because, sure. Like, I remember even as early, what was Superman 3? 82, 83?
Right.
And remember, there, Richard Pryor got the job, and he found how to hack in and steal 1 cent from everybody's account and became a millionaire overnight. And that was so early that you kind of went, it was already ingrained that that's how corporate America worked. So at what point did corporate America really adopt that if it was already part of mainstream culture by 83?
Post-World War II. Way post-World War II. Late 60s, early 70s. And when it comes to corporate computing, you had, I'm sure you've heard the term mainframe.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a mainframe computer means that we have this one big powerful computer with the tape drives and all of that, and we keep it down in the basement, and we've got one tech guy down there that hasn't seen the sun in 20 years, and he keeps it running. Meanwhile, up in the executive offices or in the accountant's offices, we have dumb terminals, all command line interface, and it was early computer networking, but they were still dumb terminals. They were just displays and keyboard type interfaces that talk to the main computer down in the basement and then spit results back out. It's not really networking, because all it was, if you could think of it as keeping the laptop in here but taking the wireless keyboard and somehow piping it to your TV.
Why am I picturing the Whopper from War Games?
That was a mainframe.
Because it's like, why? That's the picture that entered my head. Also, Barry Corbin going, I'd piss on a spark plug. I thought it'd do any good.
Yeah. You know, that was a mainframe. And they were, you know, even even in early networking, true networking, like war games, you know, where you literally dial up the computer, that was still a networked dumb terminal interface.
Well, and, all right, let's go to military then.
Sure.
Since I brought up war games. Now, obviously war games as the movie happened couldn't happen. But that type of scenario where a computer glitch has almost brought us to war has happened 4 times.
Right.
How realistic was War Games for the time it came out? For what the Whopper, for example, could do?
Not very, because if there were,
I mean, it's obvious science fiction.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how much science and how much fiction was involved.
The networking in over the telephone, that was science. Hacking into the school mainframe, that was fiction. Hacking into a computer that can literally launch all the missiles. No, that's not going to happen. I can tell you that even today, around many government installations like the Pentagon and everything. Now, you would think that almost every computer in the Pentagon would be on a network and talking to one another, right?
Actually, no, because I would think that would be very dangerous.
Yeah,
because a hacker or even, you know, a virus would infect multiple. I'd actually think for security reasons, you would specifically not do that.
Now you're thinking like the U.S. government. They use what it's people in D.C. and, you know, around the Pentagon and around those very sensitive computers that hold this
you'd
information.
You'd want to keep them isolated.
They use what's called sneaker net, which is you have to put it onto a jump drive or a disk or something like that, pop it out of the computer, and literally walk over to the other computer and put in the information that you want to exchange. And they call it sneaker net because they have...
Walking.
Well, it's walking, and they actually have a whole buttload of guys on bicycles.
Is that what the movie Sneakers was about?
No.
Because I've never seen that film. I just remember the trailer.
No. Okay. No, that was completely different. That was almost completely fiction.
Most Hollywood movies are.
But I mean, you know.
Well, because like I was watching War Games on Joe Bob Briggs' show back in the 90s.
Sure, sure.
And he had on a retired colonel. And Joe Bob was asking him, how realistic is this? He's like, well, the computer stuff's all science fiction. He goes, the military stuff, I'm sorry to say, that's actually quite accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the military aspect of it, yeah, that is quite accurate. Meh. But the computer stuff, yeah, that's pretty much fiction. I can't think of, even today, I can't really think of, like, if I could hack into my computers at university or whatever, which I did all the time. I pissed off.
Well, we're going to have a whole episode on hacking.
We'll get there.
Hacking's a whole episode, but.
But I did my fair share of hacking, and I still couldn't get to my attendance records and stuff like that.
Then since we only got a few minutes left,
sure.
Then what about computers? This can be home or like corporate or military. Why do you think Hollywood, specifically Hollywood, but you know, pop culture in general tends to do it, over exaggerates what a computer either can do or could do if they're doing a period piece, just for pure entertainment? That it would be nice if a 1988 computer could have done this, or it'd be nice if a 70s computer could have done this?
Two reasons, I think. When you look back and you over-exaggerate what they could do in the 70s, 80s, 90s, pure entertainment. And I don't know.
Like the movie Hackers.
Well, like
science fiction through and through.
Through and through, pure entertainment. The Net with Sandra Bullock.
That's science fiction all the way, yeah.
Yeah, fear.com, stuff like that.
That was just stupid, and that had computers and ghosts in the computers,
right.
So that's even less realistic. Right.
But that's just playing off of people, you know, your average Joe at the time didn't know they couldn't do this. So you do that for entertainment, and it seems somewhat plausible. And it's the Japanese.
But then,
aren't
you pushing the wrong kind of message? Then,
no.
And I'm not talking. I'm not all about messages, but you're making people think that then they get a computer and they go, "You can't do 9/10 of the shit that it did in that movie."
Right, and that's life. It's called fiction for a reason. But I mean, also, let's think of a better example: Star Trek. phasers. We didn't have phasers. We still don't. We're working on it. We're almost there.
We've got communicators. Those are right. cell phones.
We've got communicators. We've got, you know,
we've got teleporters, not like they had.
Quite
we
like
can tell we can teleport objects to other rooms. They've been able to teleport light and dust to other rooms. Read about that in Wired a couple of years ago.
Really?
We actually have teleportation, not very far, but we can do it.
But and we're working on getting better. Really, they've gotten as big as dust?
They've been able to transport light into the next room over.
I know light.
I think it was actually a side effect of the light. The dust moved over because they transported it into a clean room and there was dust in there afterwards.
Hmm.
So the dust went as well.
Weird. I hadn't heard about the dust. Anyway, I mean, that's pretty.
Like I said, the dust, I think, is actually a side effect, actually, I believe, than anything else.
But nonetheless, so we're working on teleportation. We're working on this stuff. And I think that's the other part of Hollywood, and part of its job is inspiration. I mean, you look at hackers now and you go, well, you couldn't do that back then, but
you can do maybe a 10% of that now.
We can do part of it now, and we're working on doing the rest, and you've got the hacking community working on doing the rest.
But is that wise then to continue to set the movie in 1995, for example, when it's maybe 2025 technology that they're actually dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
Click.
I'm looking for something. But the why not? I mean, you know, if you can do it, why the heck not? And if you can inspire people to do it, why the heck not?
The way I look at it is, I love science fiction, but when you're dealing with real technology, when you really are dealing with real technology, I think you should at least pretend that it's real.
I think that there is...
As a writer, I get a little irritated when people just go, it can do this because I said it can.
I think that there is a limit of plausibility. I mean, hackers, yeah, you can't do what you're doing, but there's it's plausible.
But all they would have had to do is not set that in 1995, set it in 2025, and I would have gone, okay, I totally buy this now.
No.
But in 1995, even in 1995, I went, fuck you.
No.
No, this is stupid.
No, I mean, yeah, you're right, but again, audience was a whole lot smarter about computers in 1995 than they were in
1985.
So, yeah, a little bit of plausibility, because you can watch hackers even in the 90s and go, well, maybe they could do that. Maybe, you know, especially maybe not the fighting robots of the TV station, but, you know,
I'm hacking a TV station. And you know what? That Outer Limits episode is a really good one that he kept trying to watch, too.
Yeah. OK. I'll have to look it up.
I love Outer Limits. So
I know you're quite the fan.
But so technology, last words. For this.
Right now, we're leaving off with the big mainframe computers. We're down to transistors, and integrated chips are starting to come into mainstream use. And this was still amazing to me. We're at the birth of networking, is right where we are. We're at the birth of ARPANET and stuff like that, which I will talk about next time.
Early versions of
the early versions of the internet, so that spies can talk to one another and universities can talk to one another and screw the general public, which I miss those days sometimes.
Oh well.
But I mean, you know, we're right at the dawn, right at the cusp of what we would call the modern information age. And I guess the most important thing I want people to remember is that this stuff started long before you thought it did. I mean, this is
that's why I wanted you to go into the history, because this is older than most people realize it is.
Computers, modern computers as you know them, got their first ideas for them and built analog versions of them in the early Industrial Revolution. And it was all driven by commerce, military, and later on, as we'll discover,
porn.
Which is commerce. But nonetheless, thank you all for joining us. And if you need any production work done, any voice work, anything like that, Josh and I are the people to contact. Also, video work. If you need video work done, Josh can help you out with that. We are really trying to expand this brand name. And Thanks a lot for joining us this week. We'll see you next week for part two of our tech retrospective.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.